Julia Ward Howe. You have doubtless read Uncle Tom's Cabin and through its pages learned to love the good old slave and the gentle and beautiful Ava. No doubt you have been told how deeply this story stirred the hearts of everyone when it first appeared, before a time of terrible war. Old and young, men, women, and children came to look upon the writer of this book, Harriet Beecher Stowe, as a near and dear friend, though they might never know her except through the story which she had given to them. Another woman was also a true and great helper of her country in its time of need. She did not care for wounded and dying soldiers, as did Clara Barton. She did not write a great book. But out of her loving and sorrowing heart, she gave a message to the people of her country which seems to come through her from God Himself. This message was the Battle Hymn of the Republic. It was a single poem, but it acted on the minds of the people like a shock of electricity. It inspired hope and courage when it was sorely needed. It gave fresh faith in the justice of God. Coming as it did, in the midst of a terrible war, it was worth an army in itself. It was sung in the camp and the home and on the way to the battlefield. No one can measure the strength the few lines of that battle hymn brought to millions of people. Nearly 100 years ago, the writer of this wonderful poem, Julia Ward Howe, was a little child in the city of New York. Her deep blue eyes first saw the light in quite a grand home near Bowling Green. Her father was a tall, dignified man of much wealth. Her mother was a beautiful woman with deep, dark eyes and a sweet and sensitive mouth. When Julia was only 5 years old, this mother whom she loved most dearly died, leaving 6 little children to the care of her husband. So deeply did he feel the loss that he was ill for many weeks, but at last he recovered. "I must now be mother as well as father," he said to himself, and he certainly tried his best to do his double duty. His wife's sister came to take charge of the household, and there she remained for many years, and long after her own marriage. So it was that Julia, who never forgot her beautiful mother, was tenderly cared for and had the best training possible. From her baby days, people could see that she was an unusual child. She had a wonderful memory and learned so quickly that she delighted all her teachers. She was particularly quick in mastering languages, and she wrote poems when she was still but a girl. Little Miss Ward, she was called, for she had a great deal of dignity even when she was very young. Like other little girls, Julia loved her dolls dearly, and when she was 9 years old and was told that she was too old to play with them any longer, it made her feel very sad. The child had every comfort in her lovely home, for Mr. Ward provided everything he thought wise and good for his children. But there was one thing which troubled his little Julia that he could not change. It was the color of her hair, which was a deep red gold, very fine and soft. Many people must have thought it beautiful, but the child was very sensitive about it. When Julia was about 5 years old, her father had her picture painted, showing the little girl with a pet kitten clasped in her arms and looking out of a window over which vines were trailing. The face was sweet and lovely, but no doubt the picture did not please the little girl because the red hair could be so plainly noticed. As she grew older, however, the hair became very much darker, changing to a beautiful auburn. Although Julia loved to study and was never happier than when absorbed in a book, she had a love of fun, too, and had a quick wit. Her father was very particular about the manners of his children. Never would he allow them to gossip or fool when they were in the room with him. They were to grow up into ladies and gentlemen. Therefore, they must act in constant remembrance of this in their childhood. When Julia was 14 years old, her father built a fine mansion at the corner of Bond Street and Broadway. At the time, this seemed quite out of town to his friends. It was a very grand house of brick, with white marble steps and columns, and on one side was a garden. There was a large picture gallery in the house where Mr. Ward had collected some very valuable pictures. My children must learn to enjoy art, he thought. Therefore, they must have beautiful objects to look at and study while they're growing up. Among Mr. Ward's friends were the greatest and best men of the day. They came often to the mansion on Bond Street, and thus Julia and her brothers and sisters were constantly hearing conversations that were most helpful in improving their minds. Dr. Joseph Cogswell was one of these visitors, and in course of time, Mr. Ward gave the education of his children into the hands of this learned man. He had already decided that his daughters were to receive as good a training as his sons. At that time, there were no colleges for women, but as Dr. Cogswell was finally educated, Julia was able to take as many studies under him as if she were a student at Harvard. No doubt, many of Mr. Ward's friends held up their hands in horror at this idea. A woman's place is the home, they probably said, shaking their heads and adding, much learning would make her unfit to fulfill her duties there. In after years, however, they must have changed their minds when they saw what a noble wife and mother little Miss Ward became. Dr. Cogswell was especially interested in Julia. He found her very bright, quick to understand, ever ready with thoughtful answers to his questions. It was always a delight to talk with her. Besides the teaching of Dr. Cogswell, the Ward girls studied Italian with Silvia Pellicco, an Italian exile. Altogether, Julia and her sisters had what was then considered a very superior education. Julia herself was looked upon as a blue stocking, a pretty one, however, and one who attracted much attention in the society of New York. There were few young men in the city who were considered good enough for this wise and witty young girl who could talk cleverly on almost any subject. When still a mere chit of a girl, Julia took delight in writing poetry. She was very serious for her age, and one day, after watching her two younger sisters playing a game, she chided them for being so childish. "You ought to do as I do, and write verses in your spare time," she told them. Louise did not heed her, but little Annie, who had more respect for her big sister and was very anxious to please her, sat down and struggled hard for a long time. "He hears the ravens when they call and stands them in the pleasant hall." These were two of the lines the poor child composed that day, and over which she must have often laughed in later years. Besides poems, Julia wrote in those early days articles which were published in one of the leading magazines of the country. Many delightful evenings at the home on Bond Street were given up to music. Noted musicians were among the visitors, and Julia herself was able to do her share of the entertaining. She not only sang beautifully, but also wrote many charming musical compositions. One of her brothers was so pleased with this gift of hers that he declared she ought to give up a large part of her time to it. But she was too much interested in other things to follow his advice. When Julia was 16, something happened which brought much brightness and gaiety into the quiet house. This was the homecoming of her brother Sam, or Bro Sam, as the family often called him. He had been studying for several years in Germany. He was a handsome, lively young man, a fine singer, and full of love for the music and poetry of the Germans. Julia had the most delightful times in the company of this brother. They sang German songs together, and in their talks used the German language altogether. Not long after Bro Sam's return, Mr. Ward died quite suddenly. It was a great sorrow to his children, whom he had cared for so tenderly, but they were not allowed to feel lonely. Their uncle, Mr. John Ward, took them into his home. He tried in every way to fill their father's place and give them all the happiness possible. Soon after this change in her life, Julia began to make visits to Boston. It was very different from New York, for the people were colder and not so social as in her own city. Yet the young girl had great pleasure during these visits in meeting many of the people who have since made Boston famous. Here she became acquainted with Margaret Fuller, Horace Mann, Ralph Waldo Emerson, and many others of our great American thinkers. It was at this time that she first met Dr. Samuel Howe, who was the hero of the day. He had lately returned from Greece, where he had fought nobly for that little country in its struggle for freedom against the tyrant Turks. Everyone was sounding his praises. He was a handsome man, with deep blue eyes, and was as noble and kindly as he was handsome. He was not only a thinker, but a doer, and was never so happy as when he was helping those who were in need. He was especially sorry for the blind and gave most of his thought to making their lives useful and happy. Among these blind people was a girl named Laura Bridgman, in whom he took the deepest interest. She could neither see nor hear, had no sense of smell, and very little sense of taste. She was growing up in the world with no knowledge of it except through the sense of touch. She had no way of making those around her understand what she wanted, except by a few signs. Every year, this poor child, shut out from the beauty of the world, was becoming more and more like a little animal. The girl must be helped, thought Dr. Howe, and he set to work to plan a way in which she could be taught. This was long ago, many years before Helen Keller was born, and no one as yet knew how to teach deaf mutes. Dr. Howe was very patient, however, and gave a great deal of his time to the young girl, trying as best he could to work out some way in which he could make her understand a sign language. At first he made no headway, but the day came when his love and patience were rewarded, and Laura understood. That day marked the coming of a prisoner out of the blackness of a dungeon into the glorious light of day. Step by step, and very slowly, but afterwards with greater and greater rapidity, Dr. Howe's pupil mastered the lessons he taught her. At last she was looked upon with wonder by the whole world, and the praises of her teacher were sung in America and Europe. Laura herself had the deepest love for the one who had given her freedom. To her thinking, there was no one so beautiful and good. It was not strange that Miss Julia Ward, with her brilliant mind and warm heart, found Dr. Howe more pleasing than any of her suitors. And when he appeared in New York society, the gossips began to talk. "Who is fitted to be the bride of such a noble man?" they asked each other. There was but one answer. "No one is good enough for Dr. Howe but Miss Julia Ward. She is witty and a scholar. She's musical. She is fine-looking. Best of all, she has a beautiful character." One day, after seeing Miss Ward walking along Broadway with Dr. Howe, a young New York girl described Julia in her diary. She wrote of her beautiful white hands, her dainty slippers, her white muslin dress, and her blue satin cloak. She called her the pretty blue stocking. In course of time, the news spread that Dr. Howe and Miss Ward were to be married, though the bride was scarcely 24, while the bridegroom was 40. When most girls are to be married, they spend a good deal of time and thought on their bridal clothes. But Julia Ward was not like these. She was too much interested in more important things to give much attention to the color and fit of her dress. So her two younger sisters made the preparations for the wedding. They even had hard work to get Julia to decide for herself as to what the wedding dress should be. 1 week after the marriage, Dr. and Mrs. Howe sailed from New York for Europe, where they were to make a long stay. Julia's young sister Annie, a beautiful girl, went with them. At first, Dr. Howe was not able to go about much, for he was ill with a fever and a broken leg. Afterwards, however, he took great pleasure in showing the strange sights to his young wife and her sister. Their stay at first was in England, and here Dr. Howe was looked upon with wonder because of what he had done for poor Laura Bridgman. He was spoken of as putting life into a statue. On leaving England, the party traveled slowly and comfortably about the continent. Much of the journey was made in their own carriage, and so they were able to take all the time they wished in seeing the sights. Dr. Howe was already familiar with Europe, but everything was new and fresh and wonderful to his young wife. Each day brought her new delight. After weeks of happiness in Holland, Germany, and Switzerland, the party made their way down into Italy, coming at last to the grand old city of Rome, which Mrs. Howe has since called the city of my love. So deeply did she feel that she wrote a poem which was afterwards bound in the book called Passion Flowers. One of the stanzas is this: her breath is prayer, her lips are love, and worship of all lovely things. Her children have a gracious port, her beggars show the blood of kings. The party was in Rome for 5 happy months, and it was during this stay that a little daughter was born to gladden the hearts of Dr. and Mrs. Howe. The child must be called Julia, the father declared, for to his mind no name could be more beautiful than that of his charming wife. Julia, then, it shall be, agreed Mrs. Howe, but not that alone. Let us add Romana in memory of this beautiful city. So the little daughter, who afterwards proved more beautiful in her own nature, bore the name of Julia Romana. After the Howes returned to America, they settled in Boston at the Institution for the Blind, which the noble physician had founded. The life among those whom Mrs. Howe called her blind children must have been hard for her in many ways after the beautiful home in which she had been brought up in New York. Moreover, her husband felt that no one had a right to luxury when there were so many needy people in the world. Mrs. Howe entered heartily into his plans, gladly giving up much that she had been used to in her girlhood days. She helped him in his work at the Institute all she could, bright and cheerful always, yet she was very glad when it seemed best to move into a separate house of their own. The new home was called Greenpeace. A beautiful name, was it not? Both Dr. and Mrs. Howe had such brave, strong natures and were so hopeful withal that it is very easy to imagine the feeling of rest and peace that came to the people who visited them. Their home soon became a delightful gathering place for the brightest and most thoughtful people in and about Boston. Did you ever hear that city called the hub of the universe? The term was at first used half in fun and with a little laugh, but this is the real reason. During Dr. and Mrs. Howe's life in Boston, many of the greatest men and women in America had their homes there or in the near vicinity. There was Mr. Prescott, noted for the histories which he had written. There were Theodore Parker and James Freeman Clark, who preached sermons that set people all over the world thinking. There was the artist Washington Allston and Margaret Fuller, who stirred the hearts of her listeners by her brilliant words. There was Ralph Waldo Emerson, the sage of Concord, and Wendell Phillips, the wonderful orator. When we stop to think of these and many others who were influencing the whole world to better and bigger living, and all of them from Boston, the city certainly deserved the name given to it, Hub of the Universe. You have perhaps entertained yourself at some time with a magnet, watching with delight as it attracted bits of metal to it. Mrs. Howe was a mental magnet, drawing into her circle the brightest people in the country around. In the parlors of Greenpeace, the keenest wits gathered again and again to talk over the most interesting subjects of the day. Not merely talk, either, for by the words spoken there, the whole country sometimes, indeed the whole world, was influenced. Moreover, if anyone was in trouble or in great need, he was sure to find no more willing ear to hear or hand to help than those of Dr. and Mrs. Howe. Those first years in Boston were very busy ones for the young wife. She gave all the time possible to the blind people, never neglecting, however, her own duties as a homekeeper and devoted mother. Other little children came to share her love. There were Florence and Laura, who was named for the deaf mute, Laura Bridgman. There was also a son, Henry, and last of all, Maud, the baby of the family. All these children have since grown up into noble lives, showing that they not only shared in the natures of their parents, but must also have had unusual training. Julia, the oldest, was remarkable in many ways. She was as good as she was beautiful. She never seemed more happy than when reading Shakespeare to Laura Bridgman by finger taps, or teaching German to another deaf mute. She married a young Greek, one of her father's pupils, and the young couple devoted themselves to work among the blind. She was still young when she was called to her heavenly home, and her last words were, "Remember my blind friends." The second daughter, Florence, was a fine musician and grew up to become a writer and public speaker, while Laura, a most beautiful girl, showed early a love for writing and became in due time a well-known author, as did also Maud. Henry, the only son, was a fine scholar and became a professor at Columbia University. Dr. and Mrs. Howe had good reason to be very happy in such children. In the early years of her Boston life, Mrs. Howe had little time to write poetry, but in 1854 she published her Passion Flowers. Some of these had been written during her travels in Europe. These poems were praised very highly and made quite a stir, but the name of the writer was not given. No one else but Julia Ward Howe could be the author of that book, people declared, so this secret could not be kept. 2 years after Passion Flowers appeared, Mrs. Howe gave another book called Words of the Hour to the world. These poems were quite different from the others, for the noble writer was now stirred deeply over the great question of the day. Should there be slavery in the country? To Mrs. Howe's mind, there was but one answer, and that was no. She and her husband were now busy editing a paper called The Boston Commonwealth, which was very strong in its feeling against slavery. Then came a terrible war, bringing a load of sorrow and suffering to the country. During the first year, Mrs. Howe visited the city of Washington, around which the battle was raging fiercely. Now she realized, as never before, what a terrible thing war really is. During this visit, she rode out to one of the camps where the soldiers were awaiting orders to go into battle. Colonel Green, who was in charge of the regiment, turned to Mrs. Howe and said, "Madam, you must say something to my soldiers." At that time, she had never spoken in public, and the thought of doing so frightened her. She stole from sight 3 different times, but the colonel found her out and repeated his request. At last, she gave in and made the speech. No doubt, in after times, when she had become a noted speaker, she thought often of that day when, a scared little woman, she stood before the soldiers trying to give them hope and courage by her words. Soon after this, she went with some friends to watch a review of the troops, but word came of an unexpected move of the enemy. The review had to be given up, and Mrs. Howe rode slowly back to the city with lines of soldiers on either side. She began to sing in her sweet voice the song John Brown, which is now known so well. As the soldiers listened, they shouted, "Good for you!" When the song was ended, Mrs. Howe turned to her friends, saying, "I have wished that I might write some words that could be sung to that stirring tune." That very night, the wish was fulfilled. In after years, when the war was over, Mrs. Howe was sailing with a party of friends in the waters of faraway Venice. It was a glorious moonlight evening. "Won't you tell us how you came to write the Battle Hymn of the Republic?" asked one of the party. At first, Mrs. Howe made no answer. She was doubtless thinking of the old days of war and suffering, which she had felt so deeply. Then, in a low, solemn voice, she told of the dangers and troubles which war had brought up to her people. She spoke of President Lincoln, almost hopeless and in doubt as to where to turn. Then she described how, after her visit to the camp, she had returned to Washington and sought her room, tired and sad and fearful for her country. It was a beautiful moonlight night, just such as one as this, and opening her shutters wide, she lay down on her couch to rest. Hour after hour passed by, but she was so filled with sorrow that she did not know whether she slept or not. At last a thought came to her, shaping itself into words and lines and verses, which forced her to get up from her couch and write. It was a message to the people of her country. When the work was done, she went quietly to her bed and slept till morning. Then she got up and dressed without remembering in the least what had happened in the night. As she turned to go out of the room, she noticed some writing on the table. She lifted it and began to read. It was in her own handwriting, yet at first she had no recollection of when it had been done. It was the famous Battle Hymn of the Republic, which she gave at once to her people. It awakened them to new zeal and incited fresh courage. It stirred them all, men and women, old and young, to sacrifice. It aroused such patriotism that thousands who had before held back now gladly left home and loved ones to fight for their country. The following are the lines of that terrible battle hymn, as it has been called, as Mrs. Howe gave them to the world. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. He is trampling out the vintage where the grapes of wrath are stored. He hath loosed the faithful lightning of his terrible swift sword. His truth is marching on. I have seen him in the watchfires of 100 circling camps. They have builded him an altar in the evening dews and damps. I can read his righteous sentence by the dim and flaring lamps. His day is marching on. I have read a fiery gospel writ in burnished rows of steel. As you deal with my contemners, so with you my grace shall deal. Let the hero born of woman crush the serpent with his heel, since God is marching on. He has sounded forth a trumpet that shall never call retreat. He is sifting out the hearts of men before his judgment seat. Oh, be swift, my soul, to answer him. Be jubilant, my feet. Our God is marching on. In the beauty of the lilies, Christ was born across the sea, with a glory in his bosom that transfigures you and me. As he died to make men holy, let us die to make men free, while God is marching on. 2 years after the war ended, Mrs. Howe went to Europe with her husband and two of her daughters. The little country of Greece, which Dr. Howe had once served so nobly, was again in need of his help. He had succeeded in raising a large sum of money, with which he bought supplies to carry to the suffering people. Before the Howes left Europe, they visited several different countries, besides making a long stay at Rome, the city which Mrs. Howe loved so well. Soon after coming home, she published another book called From the Oak to the Olive, which was a delightful account of her travels. And now this great lady entered with mind and heart into a new work. It was to raise the place of women in the world. They have still other duties besides those of devoted wives and mothers, she thought. She was so noble herself and had so much dignity and strength of mind that people who did not believe as she did could not help respecting her belief. Together with other ladies, Mrs. Howe formed the New England Women's Club, the first of its kind in the country. Soon afterward, she became famous as a speaker as well as a writer. Her manner was so pleasing, her voice so clear and beautiful, her words so simple yet forceful, that her hearers were always delighted. In 1872, Mrs. Howe found still a new interest. She had been deeply stirred by a war between France and Prussia, for she knew well from what her own country had suffered what a terrible thing war is. So, after a visit to the island of San Domingo with her husband, she again sailed to Europe, where she traveled about on a peace crusade. She hoped to bring about a peace congress of women, for she had great faith that if they banded together, they could do much to make war cease. Though she had many pleasant experiences during her crusade, she did not succeed in carrying out her hopes. 4 years afterwards, Dr. Howe became ill, and his wife nursed him tenderly. But he was now an old man, and for months he had been growing feeble. The most loving care was not able to bring back his health, and he died in a short time. Mrs. Howe, now a widow, again made a voyage to Europe, this time with her youngest daughter, Maud. From there the two went on to the east, visiting Egypt and the Holy Land. With what deep interest Mrs. Howe must have traveled through the country where the master once lived and taught, for she was deeply religious. With all her love for the best writings of many lands, and with all her interest in the great questions of the day, there was always one book, the Bible, which to her was the dearest and best. It was ever at her side, and to it she constantly turned for help. In her later years, Mrs. Howe had two homes. One was in Boston, the city which she had adopted as a young bride. The other was a charming summer home near Newport, Rhode Island, and here, so many of her friends thought, she was at her best. Calm and simple always, she was particularly charming there. In this Newport home, many of the most noted people of the world have passed delightful hours that are never to be forgotten. Sometimes serious, sometimes full of humor, Mrs. Howe was always the center of interest. As the years passed by, grandchildren as well as children gathered about this grand old woman of America, as she has been called, and many a happy evening have the youngsters spent about the piano as Grandma sang to them the song she learned in her own young days and which she used to sing with Bro Sam after his return from Germany. Still bright and witty, interested to the very last in making the troubles of other people lighter, Julia Ward Howe lived to the ripe old age of 90. Her last days were spent in getting together a number of poems which were published after her death. At the very end, she was able to say, "The deeper I drink of the cup of life, the sweeter it grows." At one time, she was asked what she thought was the purpose of life. She answered, "To learn, to teach, to serve, and to enjoy." She herself lived in full accord with her belief. Alice Stone Blackwell once spoke of Mrs. Howe as being like a jewel with many facets, and every facet shines. Julia Ward Howe wrote many books. She gave many lectures. She served in many great causes. But she will be best remembered by the message which through her loving and sorrowing heart was given to her people in their time of bitter need.